I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that tests the bathwater of science. We invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
So, testing the bathwater of science.
That's obviously a reference to the Archimedes.
Yeah. So, it was sent in by Damien Meehan, and he says, brings in the Archimedes link, and then explains, testing the bathwater is something you do before you put a baby in the bath to make sure it's okay. Yeah, I don't think I needed the explanation.
I'm like,
it's incredibly patronising that Damien's like, well, here's a tagline. I don't think these idiots will get it.
So. I mean, it's not a good sign, is it, really? But I wondered about the podcast that mirrors the joy of working out that you can find the density of irregular solids through the displacement of water in a bath, which has the Archimedes reference.
Yeah.
Really front and centre.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm now resigned to the fact we're never going to have... that our tagline is discussing awful taglines.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't mind that.
The show that discusses terrible taglines. and then a bit of science.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
What are we doing today? What are we talking about?
So, as you know, coronation's coming up. You're probably having to cover it, presumably.
Do you know what? Incredible coincidence. I've managed to take a bit of time off. What I can say is I found the Jubilee pretty hard work.
Right, yes.
I didn't love it. And I think everyone at work knows I didn't love it. How? Well, I told them. In no uncertain terms. So actually, yes, I have taken some time off, but also I don't think anyone was going to put me on it anyway, because they're like, well,
he will ruin it for everyone.
He doesn't really want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've become quite fascinated by, obviously, the debate about, you know, do we need a monarchy and all that kind of stuff, which I'm sort of quite agnostic about, The whole idea of leadership and why people need leaders and that whole thing, obviously, you know, you look at the government and what's going on and the change of leaderships we had over the last, you know, sort of last year, I guess.
Yeah.
And just the whole thing about leadership. And I don't know about you, but I hate leadership. I actively avoid any responsibility for other people if I can. And, you know, people said, oh, Brooksy, you should be, you know, the cricket second team cricket captain. And I'm like, A, I'm in the first team still, boys. And B.
That's a hell of a hint, though. B, yeah. I'll tell you where you'd be great, the second team.
Yeah, I said, you can drop me anytime you like, but I am not captaining the second team because I don't want the responsibility. I don't enjoy it. You know, when I left New Scientist effectively because they made me a manager. They were like, you know, I've been there a few years. I was like, how am I going to get a pay rise around here? They said, oh, you know, you become a manager. And I did it for a while. I wasn't great at it. And I really hated doing it.
Yeah. I've never done it, I don't think.
No, that doesn't surprise me.
At all.
You'd be a tyrannical manager.
Well, yeah, yeah. I think that's when occasionally I've been in a situation where someone does need to do it. I am very happy to, but I don't know if I'm good at it. I think I'm just domineering, which I'm not sure is the same thing.
I can well.
I'm basically
that.
Just like, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. So have you ever captained a football team? You must have done.
Yeah, but not in a sort of serious way, actually. Like, I have sort of nominally been the captain of, like, our five-a-side team. You don't really have a captain, do you know what I mean? It's not a... And we just kind of rotate that from season to season. So,
yeah.
No, I haven't.
I'm sort of quite interested by the concept of captaincy in football, because it seems to get handed around quite a lot in a team. Like, you know, it'll be a different person on every game almost in a lot of clubs.
Mm.
And does that suggest that it's not really, it's more of an honorary role or?
Well, there's definitely that thing of there are some players who, whether they're captain or not, they behave like the leader on the pitch.
Yes, exactly.
And it doesn't, like, giving them the armband doesn't make any difference. They're still going to conduct themselves in the same way.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a sort of, well, it's going to be a learned
It's interesting,
behavior,
isn't it? Yeah, you've got the, you know, you've got 11 in your team, and there's always one or two characters that seem to have sort of leadership qualities that just rise out of them somehow.
Yeah, a
sometimes
lot of it is being vocal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then you've got, like, the leadership that you get from a manager in football as well. Like, you know, like, Klopp's leadership is clearly, you know, excellent. And his leadership skills are excellent, even if not getting the performance this season.
Yeah.
And somebody like Guardiola, people perform for him. You know, there's something about that that, you know, isn't the same for other managers.
And you wonder if that
like
is...
Graham Potter.
Because, well, yeah, but then you look at, you know, he did really well at Brighton and the players were clearly doing what he wanted there. You do wonder if there's a sort of overlap with being charismatic, because both, in quite different ways actually, both Pep and Klopp are very charismatic, engaging men.
Yeah.
And so maybe that is a prerequisite for being a good leader, that you need to have a sort of charisma. But then when you look into the sphere of politics, there's probably quite a few people who you would say were good leaders without being charismatic.
Yeah. I mean, I would say somebody like, you know, like Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown were not charismatic people, but actually in some ways were quite good leaders.
Gordon Brown, I guess it's slightly... Well, Ed Miliband never got into power, so...
No, true. But he was leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Couldn't eat a bacon sandwich.
Well, I mean...
undoing.
That was a disgrace, because, I mean, genuinely, I think if you take 100 photos of anyone...
I've seen you eat a bacon sandwich.
You're going to find a shot where it doesn't look great.
Yeah.
You really are.
Who's your favourite leader?
From any field?
Any sphere, any time in history.
It's really hard to think away from football, isn't it?
It is, actually, yeah.
Bizarrely, because that's sort of our main exposure to lead, where it's not us being led.
Yeah.
Our main exposure to something where you feel like you can see visible effects of it as well.
Or, you know, for me, like cricket, like Ben Stokes taking over the England Test captaincy transformed them.
But is that not more about Brendan McCullum, though?
I think it's both of them.
Yeah.
But there is that kind of sense of, like, how does that happen? That's an amazing
leadership.
It is
intriguing when they are the same players. It's pretty much exactly the same players.
Yeah.
And just playing in a totally different style with a kind of freedom and, like...
I think leadership is fantastic. My favourite leader, I'm going to give you time to think, is a guy I discovered when I was writing my math book, King Shulgi of Ur. So 4,000 years ago, he was like the king of like what's now sort of Iraq and around there. And he taught himself or was taught as a child how to do certain bits of maths.
Mm-hmm.
And he found it so powerful that he basically instituted mathematical reforms across his kingdom, made everyone do proper accounting, like changed the whole... Basically, the country became really rich through his ability to do maths. But then he also made his subjects sing hymns of worship to him because he could add and subtract.
That's really good. I've got a really awful sinking feeling, which is... So this is not my... And it is in football, and it's not my favourite leader, but probably the best leader that I've sort of witnessed. I feel sick to say it. It's probably Ferguson.
I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah, but it probably is. You look at what he did at United and for so long and reinvented the team, where it's so clear that it is about him.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I think quite tyrannical, harsh, and difficult.
And the little windows into it are always intriguing and sort of alarming.
So very un-Klopp-like, I think.
Yeah, as far as
I understand it.
I think Klopp is probably bawling some people out as well.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he just keeps a lid on it a bit more sort of when he's outside the dressing room, but I think he probably gets pretty... I mean, look at him on the touchline.
Yeah, it's
that
true.
That guy's going absolutely mad.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it might... Oh, God, yeah, it might be Ferguson. And I really loathed that man. But you can't...
You can admire leaders and still loathe them, can't you?
Yeah.
Isn't that an incredible thing?
Mm. Yeah. Is there anyone in... There must be someone in politics in my lifetime that I thought, you're a good leader.
Well, you almost don't want to say it, though, do you? Because I remember when Tony Blair was elected.
Actually,
and I was like, oh, this is really good, and this is going to be really good for the country, and he's really good, and, you know, lots of the legacy is not so good.
Yeah. But, yeah, but he does fit into the mould of someone who is just... And that's why him and Brown, actually, I suppose, were a good...
Yeah, because he's got that charisma, hasn't he?
Yeah.
That Brown didn't have, I guess.
Yeah, and, I mean, really pragmatic.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit too pragmatic to be a really good leader.
Incredibly. I remember he said that he decided that it was easier to get to the top of the Labour Party than the Conservative Party. So that's why he basically became a Labour Party politician, which isn't a great look.
No. I mean, it's quite Boris Johnson 2 articles, isn't it?
Yeah.
Since the beginning of civilization, we've looked for leaders from tribal chiefs to modern-day CEOs. And leaders have emerged to provide direction and guidance for groups of people. But where does the human need for leadership come from? Psychologically, what makes us follow a certain person? And what impact, good and bad, can a leader have on individuals and groups? Throughout history, leaders have been praised for their bravery, intelligence and charisma. But what about the less glamorous aspects of leadership? The sacrifices, the tough decisions, the constant pressure to succeed. With the King's coronation just days away, this week's episode feels particularly pertinent. We're asking, why do we need leaders? Have we got an expert?
Yes, we have. And it's not me.
That's a relief.
We've got Professor Andre Spicer, who is, get this, Executive Dean of Bayes Business School and Professor of Organisational Behaviour at City University.
Bayes as in Bayes, as in Bayesian probability and stuff?
Probably not. I don't know. I haven't looked at that. No, it seems unlikely.
But he is a leader himself.
He is. Actually, when you talk to him, he says it's very much a team operation, and he might have the title of Executive Dean.
He's Executive Dean, come on.
He's an alpha male.
Is that a fair term?
And we use it, don't we? But I don't think it is a fair term for humans, because basically animals are pretty different to, or other animals, I should say, are pretty different to how we operate in our society. So you've got like leadership in like chimps. Obviously you get alpha males, or as you know, that's what we've called them, which are tend to be the strongest ones, the ones that win the fight to get there and are constantly then having to defend, you know, their position. With spotted hyenas, you get alpha females. And again, they're the strong ones. They're the ones that, you know, you don't want to take on in a fight. But you've got things like in African elephants and orcas, you've got the oldest female leads the group. So wisdom, basically, and wisdom and experience is what counts for their group survival. You've got the sort of the lioness who is best at recognizing threats, like hearing calls and you know, hearing other roars from other groups. She gets to be the leader of their pack, which is interesting. And then you've got sticklebacks, where it's just the best looking individual. Basic bitches.
As measured by, how do we know?
As measured by the group. It's like basically like the smoothest skin.
The sexiest stickleback.
Sexiest stickleback.
Leads.
Oh, literally, you're the big fish in the small pond.
That's nice.
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways in which evolution has got social animals sort of to pick a leader. But you know, most of them do have these sort of hierarchies and organizations. But, you know, the ones that are closest to us, things like the chimps, they're sort of thugs and self-interested sort of leaders and terrorize everyone else. You do get occasional chimp leaders that are kind of they collaborate. So you'll get a kind of almost like a duo or a trio who sort of work together to take over the leadership of a group. But, you know, generally it tends to be kind of thugs. And obviously human leaders, you know, can't just go around beating people up. Certainly not on an individual level. You know, you can hire the right people to do it, I guess. But, you know, human leadership is much more about sort of, you know, understanding power dynamics and sort of getting a specialized role and sort of really exploiting your particular niche.
So I was just literally trying to Google fit sticklebacks. but just briefly.
Did you find them?
They all sort of, some with the greatest threat, they all look the same to me. But there is a sort of, there is a logic to that, isn't there? Because fundamentally, the sticklebacks are looking at the nicest, the best phenotype.
Yes.
So the best, like, expression of genes.
Expression of gene quality, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's sort of
survival ability.
It should be a decent indicator that this is the best quality genetic material available.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's the best stickleback, and therefore, this guy should be breeding with us all.
But that's not necessarily the one that's, like, the best at finding food or the best at kind of social dynamics.
No.
I don't know if you can talk about stickleback personalities. I think you can, actually, but I think...
Well, you know this guy's going to be arrogant. He's just like, I know where you've picked me. Look at his face.
Look at his face.
But it's not, like, it's not a, it's not an entirely banal way of picking your leader.
I mean, they're not, like, you know, drawing lots or, you know, no. They're not chucking the dice.
Yeah.
So
and being a good-looking stickleback does tell you something about the sort of genes within, doesn't it?
Well, I guess that guy wants you to think so.
But it does.
It sort of does.
It does.
You're only saying that because you used to be a model.
Yeah. Long, long time ago. Back to humans. Presumably, human leadership has changed quite a lot over time.
Yeah, so the people who research this identify three sort of different periods. Like, the first one is where the Homo first sort of emerged into the savannah. So, like, 2.5 million years ago, mm-hmm. until about 13,000 years ago. And then it was basically, you know, hunter-gatherer bands, sort of fairly small, 50 to 150 people.
Yeah.
And the leadership would be quite sort of low hierarchy. So you wouldn't, like, lord it over everyone. But there were certain people with sort of recognized qualities, like, you know, sort of known to anthropologists as, like, the big men, the ones who had a bit of something extra about them and could just say, right, we're just going to go and do this. Mm. But you'd still need everyone else to sort of be with you and cooperate and everything else.
Yeah.
So you get that kind of, and we still see this in hunter-gatherer societies today, in that you get, you know, leaders. And they're quite often, you know, physically, maybe a bit more to them than the others. But it's not like, you know...
Like the sticklebacks.
Sticklebacks. The sticklebacks of the savannah. But they're not like, you know, just sitting in on a throne somewhere, like,
no,
ordering people
like
about. They're very actively involved in everything.
Like you said, like, low hierarchy.
Real collaboration, with your, you know, what are almost self-declared subordinates.
Yeah. We're all going to go and do something and someone just needs to make a decision on what we're going to do. It might as well be me.
So that's fine.
I'm slightly better looking than you guys.
Well, you know, it will be, I can chuck a spear the furthest with the greatest accuracy.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, which you've got to hand it to them.
Useful stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it is useful stuff. And then, of course, 13,000 years ago, agriculture, we settled down. All of a sudden, people can specialize, do different kinds of things. There's decisions need to be made about how things are done.
And immediately it's throne, bring me a throne.
Someone.
I'm in the nicest hut.
I mean, and you kind of need, because you're trading with other groups as well, so you need people who are just sort of dedicating time and effort to doing that kind of thing. And you're also accumulating surplus of crops and surplus of this and that and the other, cloth. You know, you're trading with other groups. So all of this needs some coordination. And so you get somebody who'll say, I'll handle that. I'll take care of that. And they've got the sort of, you know, wherewithal really to give themselves some trappings of power in some ways. It's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to need somewhere to sit and do this, and I'm going to need somewhere to kind of host this reception for the neighboring tribe kind of thing. And all of a sudden it just becomes this sort of much bigger sense of like, oh, there's somebody here who's sort of got all the power and making all the decisions. And you know, there might be a few of them, but really there'll be a hierarchical structure where somebody comes out and then if you get, you know, disgruntled with them, they chuck you out of the society because they've armed themselves with a few big guys around them.
Yeah.
Who are they paying off because they're getting a bit of extra money because they're in charge of all the money.
Yeah.
And you've got this situation where you've got sort of the potential for despots, but also just, you know, people just doing really sort of, you know, what we would see as very leader kind of things where they've got a bit of power. They know how to hold on to it, and they're making society run because you know you don't want people to be totally disgruntled.
No, but that won't work.
So you have to give a bit back, and there's this sort of, you know, sense of, you know, you let me do this and you let me have this and I'll sort you out and do all this kind of thing, and you'll have enough food and you'll have somewhere to live and it'll be safe. So you kind of establish yourself a little fiefdom, and then you've got basically, you know, big hierarchical structures. And effectively, I mean, that sort of goes on until pretty much the Industrial Revolution in most societies. You get this sort of sense of, you know, because like in British society, you get the aristocracy and the, you know, the barons, and you get the people with a bit of power who just, you know, lord it over some people who have no power whatsoever.
At what point do people start invoking sort of God-given rights?
I don't really know. I mean, probably quite early, don't they?
I think so, yeah.
Because, you know, you get the right priests on side. And the whole priesthood thing is about, it's a power play, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, I'm your priest leader. And the Egyptians, you know, were famously god kings. And so you didn't question them because it was like questioning the gods kind of thing. So it's very, you know,
it's a good setup, actually.
It makes a lot of sense to be doing that kind of thing. Mm. And the priests had their sort of rituals, and people were properly afraid of getting on the wrong side of them. So if you're controlling the priest and you're a self-declared sort of god, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
People aren't buying it these days so much.
But. No. But back in the day, you could definitely get away with just going, well, do you really want to mess with me? Bear in mind, I am a god.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you
okay, Ramesses.
And you had the means to make sure that people, you know, suffered if they did come rise up against you. So, yeah. So it's like the obvious next step, isn't it? Once you've got your palace and your throne, you're like, oh, actually, yes, you better worship me as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'll ruin the harvest for everyone.
Like an Adam subtracts.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was one of Shulgi's moves. It's like, worship me. He declared himself a god. I mean, the funny thing is that, I mean, he couldn't multiply or divide.
Yeah.
So it's like...
That'd be awkward in the court, wouldn't it? Everyone's just firing, just like, go on, take 3 from 7. He's like, no problem. So I was like, okay, what's 15 times 12? You're like, kill him. How dare you?
I love Shulgi. But then, like, so when the Industrial Revolution happened, you had a slight shift in sort of in these kind of the patterns of society, especially, you know, in Britain, Western Europe. You had people starting working for people in factories or whatever, and they would work for their boss, but they'd get wages, and they could go and work for another boss equally. So you had to be a bit sort of careful about how you wielded power over people. So you changed power structures a little bit. And then this is something that Professor Andre said, you basically get the two world wars, and they make a huge difference because no longer are you ruled really by the ideas of monarchy.
One of the biggest evolutions we've seen is the movement away from kind of leadership being an inherited position. So often you would gain your sense of leadership, your ability to lead a group based on inherited characteristics, whether you're coming from a particular family or a particular social class. And that's basically how, for instance, if we think about leadership being distributed in 19th or 18th century British society, it was based on, you know, are you from the social class, which family are you from? And then the assumption would be, because you're born into that society, that class, because you went through this educational system, you then had the characteristics to become a leader. Now, the interesting thing which happened is this began to break down after World War I and particularly after World War II, because all of these people were in the military, they got put into military positions, they went out, many of them weren't particularly competent, So they often ended up into, particularly during World War One, leading groups of people who either got killed or the individual leaders got killed themselves. So it then said, okay, to direct our divisions in the army, we no longer have enough people from these kind of backgrounds who we think are naturally leaders. So we actually have to go out and select and train people into positions of leadership. As we've moved into the modern era, as organizations have got larger, societies have got larger, we find increasing movement towards rational forms of leadership, which are basically people gain their leadership position based on the position which they hold within a large organization. And that often is their ability to negotiate and maneuver within formal systems of rules, regulations, and professional knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, it's very surprising that royal blood doesn't make you a great soldier.
I always think it's really interesting because, like, obviously William was protected from service, Prince William, because he's like first in line, or he is now first in line to the throne, and Harry was allowed to go because he was sort of dispensable.
Yeah,
but you look at the two of them and you think, who would I rather have alongside me in a battle? Obviously Harry.
Yeah.
So obviously Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, I think it's sort of, you know, it probably does make sense that actually there's not going to be every royal that's good at being a soldier. I mean, Prince Charles went to, did he go to war? No, he wouldn't have done, would he?
Don't think so, no.
Andrew was sent to the Falklands.
Yeah.
He was, and then couldn't sweat after that.
Do you want to say anything about him? I think probably we don't. enough has been said. With my BBC hat on.
Anyway, so you know, what we might have chosen in the past as being a great leader, you know, who became our king because they were a great fighter, that doesn't happen anymore. That's not. It's like an evolutionary mismatch.
Yeah.
Now.
So it just doesn't what we work want today, and what we wanted in the past are not.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't really overlap that much.
No, but we still have the kind of hangovers left of things like that. So we elect like tall presidents, like the US always has kind of, you know, a certain look to the person, you know, they're male, and they're, you know, you can't be a big fat president, really. You have to have a certain something about you, although Trump sort of, you know, pushed the boundaries slightly, I think. But there's that sense of people want to have taller leaders, and that is a bias that's sort of been recorded in the literature. And they also want people who are sort of, you know, older, effectively, because they want that sort of wisdom and experience, sort of sense of, oh, this person really knows how to, you know, they don't know that person knows, but they have this evolutionary hangover, almost like you've got to be a bit older and more experienced, and, you know.
Joe Biden's pushing the envelope a bit,
isn't he? Yeah, he really is.
And can you be too old and too wise?
So we definitely have that kind of sense of, and if we're in an era of war, people are much more likely to elect, obviously, a hawkish president because they want somebody who's going to engage in it properly, which is not necessarily, rationally, you want the most strategic and
I'd go
careful.
Dove.
Yeah,
personally.
Yeah. But that's not the way that it goes because we have this sort of natural leaning to have our politicians basically do what they used to do, you know, medieval knights or kings or whatever, you know, the idea of the sort of Henry VIII and the big strapping sort of soldier, warrior, you know, we want that. And yet we don't realise that that's not what we need at all.
Mm-mm-mm-mm. So what's the solution then if we're sort of picking the wrong people?
Well, I mean, we have to sort of step back. And one of the things that Professor Andre said is like, not go for the stereotypes, think about the stereotypes and make sure we don't sort of choose leaders. And this goes in the corporate world as well, obviously. If you're in a group where there's actually quite a lot of internal conflict, it's been shown that the best thing to do is have female leadership, because actually, you know, there's a different cultural operation in terms of, you know, dealing with conflict and actually managing it well. But people tend to vote for a male president when their country's at war and a female president more likely when their country's at peace.
Mm.
So people aren't sort of seeing the way that they kind of might have subtle biases and that kind of thing. And you can have, you can flatten the hierarchy structure. So what you want is a good team effectively.
It's more like the hunter-gatherer style structure.
Yeah, yeah. But the problem is that's not something that we naturally go for, because our instinct is basically wrong. So there's a guy called Paul Lawrence who sort of sees leadership as shaped by human evolution. And leaders have to hit, if they want to get elected and want to stay sort of in power, they have to hit certain really quite basic human drives. So one of them is the drive to acquire resources and offspring. So people under their leadership want to be able to get, stuff and have kids and safely sort of pass on their genetics.
Yeah.
And then they have to honor the drive to defend yourself. So you have to let people sort of operate in a sort of self-defensive way and nothing can encroach on them. I mean, just this is America, isn't it? The drive to get stuff, to defend yourself and have the right to defend yourself. And then he says there's two other things which are not so animal. So humans have a sort of desire to bond, a strong drive to bond with others. So you have to respect that and give people the sort of chance to live in communities, and you have to keep your own promises, and you have to have fair exchanges so that people can trust each other. So you have to engender trust in society. And then the other thing that he says humans are sort of different about is that they have to tell truths. So humans have to comprehend, understand what's going on around them. They want to be aware of everything, and just be able to interact with each other according to sort of, truths, and trust each other with information and learn about how things operate around them. And so
feels like that's all going to shit at the moment.
And doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So that's not what leaders are necessarily doing right now, which is kind of interesting.
Aren't there situations in which we would be better off without leaders?
So the hunter-gatherer societies used to pass, or still do, pass leadership around depending on the task at hand. So, if there was something that I was the leader, I was maybe the leader in battle, but I'm not. I'm
sure.
What are you laughing at?
No, fine. Yeah.
I mean, that seems obvious to me.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
But not necessarily the leader in like cooking.
Mm,
So I would defer and just, and so it becomes a kind of almost like a delegation thing. People are delegating
to each
other.
It's a more sort of technocratic approach, isn't it? You go, you're the best at this, so you get on with it.
Yeah, but that only works in relatively small groups. So like, 50 to 150 people, you can kind of manage that. And after that, it gets out of control. But and this is why these sort of researchers theorize why so much management in corporate structures fails, because people are just sort of not able to delegate properly, not able to share leadership responsibilities. The failure rate of senior managers in American corporations runs at 50%. It's like half of them can't do it.
Wow.
And then and managerial incompetence accounts for 60 to 75% of business failures in corporate America.
Is that not a sort of variation of the Peter principle, though?
Yeah, I think it is.
And like, so I know several people, I think, who have gone into a career because they have an interest in that career, in doing that thing. And as you progress up the ladder, you do less and less of the thing and more of running an organization and managing people. And there's not really anything to say you're going to be good at that.
Yeah.
But you just, like, that's obviously where people are going to come from who end up in those positions.
That's effectively what happened to me at New Scientist, is that, I was good at sort of editing, commissioning, writing features.
Yeah.
And then I was promoted to actually run other people who were doing that. And there's a certain level
at
which
you had
that's
some self-awareness, which was that A, you didn't want to do that, and B, you didn't think you were that good at it. I think most people probably just sort of crack on.
Yeah, maybe.
Until they're told their shit.
But one of the interesting things is that Andre said at one point, he said, if you're going to go to a hospital, you want to go to a hospital that's run by somebody who used to work as a doctor. Don't go to a hospital that's run by somebody
run by a bureaucrat.
Yeah, basically only ever done management, because the statistics say that you're more likely to die in an operation. So he said it just run down. So there has to be a sweet spot of like experience in management.
Yeah.
And they have to be able to delegate and not be too hands-on and know when other people are good at the job.
Well, it's a classic argument around career politicians, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, are you do you end up being good at politics and delegation and all that kind of stuff if you just spend your life dedicated to politics? Or do you need that real world experience? And I think generally the sense that people have is they'd much rather their politicians have real world experience because they think it gives them more understanding of,
yeah,
you know, what's kind of real life outside the West, you know, in the UK, the Westminster bubble is
exactly
like.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much that is borne out in fact. And it's probably quite a hard thing to try and.
Yeah, I mean, this is why people study leadership, but there's actually not much really good sort of data to work on from that kind of perspective, because, you know, society is shifting the whole time as well. So now you've got the situation where you've got technology coming in, and, you know, what's a good leader and a good manager in the age of bots who can do a lot of the work? And, and do you instruct bots, or do you program bots or AIs to lead people and tell them what tasks to do? Well, actually, no, you can't do that, because people need human engagement and that bonding kind of thing. You can't just have a bot as your leader or an AI as your leader or your manager.
Something I've definitely noticed in the last few months is you get quite a lot of these statements, grand statements from politicians about things like AI and actually... we'll have this episode coming up, Fusion, and you read it and you think, you have no idea what you're talking about. And it's really obvious you have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And you should be surrounded by some people who do, but would it be better to have someone who would, you know, like at least got some sense of it, like, you know, some, I don't even know what the background would be, maybe they've worked in big tech or something like that.
Well, you'd hope, wouldn't you? I mean, I sort of feel like, I remember, you know, back in 2010 when I ran for Parliament and formed the Science Party, and, you know, and ran on the basis of, you know, wouldn't it be good to have some people in the House of Commons who had some understanding of science?
Mm.
And there were very few, and there's even less now.
Yeah.
And actually, you sort of think, yeah, it would be good, because you want people to make informed decisions. You want people to be able to look at something like, you know, climate change and actually understand what the uncertainties mean.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And things like that. So real world experience really does matter.
But maybe I suppose the counter argument is those people should be in the civil service. They should be the people who are and advising.
Like,
you don't necessarily need your politicians to have that.
No,
wherewithal.
But a few of them wouldn't hurt.
Instinctively, it feels to me like that would be a good thing.
And if you've got people who are coming out of a 30-year career in a laboratory or working in science and understanding that, that's got to be helpful rather than coming out from having a degree in PPE from Oxford.
Although, what's the incentive? Like, I don't know what the incentive would be to go from a successful career in, you know, some form of scientific endeavour to then go and be a politician. I mean,
Public service?
I just don't think being a politician is much fun.
No, I got that impression. I mean, I met quite a few of them and didn't want to spend any time with any of them.
No.
And I thought the last thing I'd want is to be an MP in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
And luckily, I lost my deposit.
Okay, let's take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll ask what types of leadership we can expect to encounter in life, why people seek power, and we'll answer this week's question, why do we need leaders?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. Talking about the fact that leaders aren't always necessary. So why do we bother?
Yeah. So I mean, there are situations where you have the right kinds of people doing the right job, and they're self-motivated, and they're not really in need of sort of interference from above, if you like. But we still need leaders generally. Because, as Professor Andre says, they're basically symbols of our societal norms. They keep us running along the tracks.
So often leaders are seen as embodiments of the social norms which the group lives by. So they're supposed to kind of being a living symbol of the social norms of the group. So often the group looks towards the leader as a kind of signal of the norms which that whole group is supposed to follow. And what's interesting is that during times of change within a group, they often try and appoint a leader who symbolizes the norms they're trying to move towards. So for instance, if a company is trying to say, okay, we want to move from being a manufacturing company to being a tech company, then they would appoint a leader from a tech background. And that's great in terms of sort of projection, but it then sets up tension with the people who are from, you know, abiding by the old norms of the group. So that's one point. The second thing which is interesting about leaders is that often they are given more free rein to break the norms of their social group. So what you often get is what's called middle status conformity within the group. So the people who are kind of at the lower status level, no one cares whether they break a norm or rule because they're somehow outside of the status groups and it's expected of them. The people who are in the middle tend to be the most conforming to social norms. So this is the classic sort of middle management problem. And then the people who are at the top are often given some degree of free rein to break the norms of that group and kind of act out. And that can be beneficial in some ways because it allows for innovation and change, but it also can be extremely damaging in other times where you get narcissistic people, you know, CEOs who are acting out these weird fantasies of their own and don't seem to be bound by the rules and regulations which apply to everyone, but everyone else has to suffer from their decisions.
Yeah, I sort of feel like I'm probably in the middle.
Yeah, me too.
I don't like it.
Conforming.
Yeah.
I mean, I do conform, I think. You know, if I'm in an organisation, I don't really, you know, I'm not one of those people who just breaks it, is disruptive and goes out and sort of does my own thing and everyone goes, oh, that's amazing. But I don't think that's a bad thing because I don't think many people have a positive influence when they do that.
No, and also you do need mainly conformists for to sort of run. Otherwise, it's just anarchy, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
I mean, one thing, I mean, I am very, very bad with authority figures.
Right.
Like, I really rail against them, but it feels like a sort of personal animus rather than...
Yeah, and you probably just avoid them wherever possible,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do some stuff which feels like that I can't, when I take a step back, I'm like, I don't know why I've... Almost like self-sabotage as a sort of... make a point. I'll just like... I'm very easily riled up by if someone tells me what to do or what not to do, even if they're right, it really pisses me off.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I'll just, and I hold a grudge. And so I'll just, I'll hang on to that. And then I'll just sort of send an email. Well, you've seen glimpses of glimpses of stuff where you think, well, that no one is really benefited from this. And I sort of know it, and I know.
I've watched you like basically set yourself on fire.
Yeah, like I can't stop myself. I'm just like, fuck you.
And then you send me an email saying, don't respond to that.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, don't respond to what I'm just because this person's saying he's going to sue us. True story.
I mean, I'm sort of interested that you can get to this position of power, and we see it time and again, and you just start to abuse your power because that, you can.
I think that is the source of my frustration with it. There's that I so often see people who have power and are using it poorly.
Yeah, and for self-serving ends.
Yeah, and no one is really able to challenge it, or is so. They're so worried about, you know, whether it's keeping their job, you know, that they just can't, they'll never push back. And I always just think, well, fuck it, I'll push back.
Yeah.
Which is quite self-destructive. I don't think I can't remember an example where it's ever helped me. or, other than in that very brief moment, made me feel any better.
But it's interesting because I see those people sort of enjoying having power, doing what they want, getting away with stuff. Nothing in me still wants to be that person or be in power. I don't understand, you know, like, see people like campaigning in local council elections at the moment, and it's like, I'm really glad you want to do that.
Yeah,
I don't understand why you want to do that.
Yeah, it's quite something, isn't it?
That public service sort of contract.
You got to, I mean, you got to admire it.
Yeah, but apparently, according to the researchers in this field, it's like it's a reciprocity thing. Like they get something out of being like their personality is such that they enjoy that sense of mm-hmm. I'm making decisions mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. this, and I've got some control over my environment. And, you know, and that's one of the classic sort of things of a leader is that people go into it because they want to get some control. So they might be actually quite exercised by, I don't know, the amount of litter in their in their environment. And they I'm going to do something about this. And in order to do something about this, I have to actually get myself elected and do this kind of thing.
But there must be some element of people wanting to, you know, improve the lot of the population.
Yeah, I think
that
so.
Population might be.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a public service sort of vibe that these people give out.
But then you also get eroded, doesn't it?
You also get people who like just want to be in control of other people.
Yeah,
that's the other side of this. And you get, and I'm sure it's the same with local councillors. It's just like I want to be somebody in this society. You know, even if it's a small pond, I want to be a big fish, kind of thing. And and that's where you get problems because those people then are the ones that really sort of tend to start abusing the power and trying to control the people under them. And sort of basically that's when it sort of all goes wrong. But Interesting. So one of the things that Andre said was that many people exhibiting leadership skills is just a way of getting out of admin. So it's like,
I don't want to do this.
I want to be the
shit.
I'm going to be the leader.
I'd like to tell you to do it.
I'd like to tell you to do it. So it's sort of like, you know, it needs to be done. And it's effectively, I want to be a delegator, not a doer.
Yeah.
And I've certainly come across those people. But it's sort of, I mean, he's in a university environment, obviously. And so his.
Is he a good leader?
I don't think he would answer that question necessarily. Sure. He's identified six types of leader. So he edited published a book. He was a co-editor of it. Six leadership types that he says sort of exist out there. I've got an idea which one you would be.
Okay, go on.
One is the cyborg. So it's a leader who sort of transcends what's human and non-human. It's like, it's slightly above us, slightly not us. I mean, I'm thinking Elon Musk, sort of that vibe that he gives off of, like, you know, I'm sort of a bit above all of you.
Or just, slightly sort of, not inhuman, but, other.
Yeah,
as well.
Slightly other.
Like Zuckerberg. Yeah.
Then there's the bully. Mm-hmm. Which I think you might be. So my PhD supervisor was an absolute bully. Yeah. I mean, he was ended up suspended on bullying charges, which is kind of proof, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was in that's just how he worked, by intimidation.
What sort of stuff?
Well, like, a friend of mine who was working on his PhD at the time, same time as me, he his equipment broke, or he was careless about it, and it broke, and it set everything back sort of about 6 weeks or something. And my supervisor said, you do something like that again, I'm going to stab you.
Yeah, that's not on, is it?
No, not really. Yeah. And said it quite coldly. Mm. And then, you know, he would just shout at people and rail at people, F and blind at people, you know, if anything was sort of out of line. He was controlling and a bully, basically. He's dead now, by the way, so he can't sue me.
Yeah, okay, good.
and then you get the commander, who basically says what must be done and intimidates people into doing it, and you know, you don't disobey him, and he sort of thinks of himself as, you know, the ass kicker kind of, you know, guy. You know, I'm the guy who
thinking maybe I'm more that guy than the bully.
I don't think that is you.
No, maybe not.
I think you're more just like, do what I say.
Yeah. But I don't think I'm threatening to stab anyone.
No. Okay, I'll give you that. But the commander is a bit more like, you know, I'm going to be the leader of the charge. I'm going to be involved in it. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And you know, you've all just got to follow me, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then there's the saint. Mm-hmm. So somebody like Obama, you know, this kind of idea that somebody's going to be transformative just because of who they are.
Yeah.
You put them into leadership and it's going to change
sort of
everything.
Aura. Yeah.
That's Nelson Mandela, I think, was probably in a similar sort of vein.
It's not me, that. Yeah.
No, it's not me either. The gardener, who kind of cultivates the ground for everyone else to be able to flourish in.
Now, that feels like a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's not me either.
No.
I don't think that's me. I'm just not interested in leading. I don't want anybody else's stuff in my vision.
No, you made that abundantly.
Yeah.
You don't trust anyone.
Yeah, I don't trust anyone to do a decent job.
Yeah.
I have to say, I do it myself. Yeah. like I mean, I'm amazed we've got an expert for this episode, for instance. And then, actually, I did wonder whether King Charles III... as he will be crowned, might be a gardener type. Because I don't think he's a bully. I don't think he's a commander.
No, it doesn't feel like it, no.
He's certainly not a saint.
No.
So I'm sort of wondering whether the gardener is his thing, where he sort of feels like if he just, you know, sets an environment, you know.
Anyway. Yeah, I can see that.
And then the final one is the buddy. So the one who tries to be your feel-good mate alongside you. Sort of a bit David Brentish kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is definitely not me.
Like groovy teacher.
That guy. Yeah. Absolutely hopeless. I hate those people.
Oh, what are we doing back here? Yeah, go on, I'll have a quick drag on the spliff. Yeah. Don't tell the tax man.
It's a very inexact science. It's a very young science in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's constantly, you know, it's striving for data because, you know, every situation is different. So it's really hard to sort of really make any sense of it at all. But luckily, I mean, I was thinking about King Charles and, you know, what he's going to be like, and I said he might be the gardener, but actually I had to look at his horoscope. Because we're into that now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. According to his horoscope, his signs are all sun, moon, and rising signs. His sun is in Scorpio, his moon's in Taurus. He's basically got signs that he could be a rigid and inflexible person. So,
okay.
Let's see if that bears out.
Okay.
If you've not listened to our astrology episode, you can take that at face value.
I'm still trying to work out where the reason I think I might not be a bully as a leader is, and you might find this surprising, people like me. And it is one of the great mysteries in some senses, given my personality.
We should probably do an episode on that.
Yeah, why do people like me? I've got lots of unlikable personality traits, but
it's actually true. I'd never really thought about it, but yeah, people do like you.
Yeah, they do. But sort of objectively, they probably shouldn't, and yet somehow they
do.
Well,
you don't give a shit about them in general.
No, no.
But that, and you don't like most people.
No.
But I do, most people do like you.
Yes. Yeah. Which
is a mystery, isn't
it? Strange. And that, well, it's not that I don't like. I do like talking to people. I'm sort of interested by people.
Yeah.
And then I've got a tight group of people I actually want to spend time with.
Yeah. Which is normal.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
Abnormal.
Yeah. Yeah. But I couldn't really. I think if you put my sort of list of personality ingredients down, I don't think you would say, oh,
nobody's voting for that guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People are going to like this guy. And I totally accept that. But the strange thing is, they do.
Yeah. Well.
And then I think, you know, the bully thing doesn't quite.
I don't think you'd follow through on threats. That's the thing.
No. So but your PhD supervisor probably wouldn't. I don't know if I would.
No. Maybe I've got you wrong. Maybe I'm maligning you. Yeah. Unfairly.
No, I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to think.
So interesting. So I was, you know, we were asking Professor Andre about King Charles, you know, horoscope aside.
Yeah.
And he thinks, and this might be quite controversial, I don't know. He basically said, looks like he's going to be a low power leader.
One observation is that there's a lot of historical work on royalty, which shows that as they have become less and less important for actual decisions and having actual power in the organisation, the ceremonial aspects of particularly handing over power and symbols of power have become more and more intense. So what you tend to find is that if you go back into the sort of, you know, 18th century or whatever, coronations and, you know, funerals and so forth were a complete mess, and they were not coordinated at all, and people would catch cold in Westminster Abbey during the thing, and, you know, they were poorly organised, and there wasn't a lot of pomp and ceremony. Whereas if you fast forward to today, you know, in a few weeks' time, what we're going to witness is a huge, extremely elaborated ceremony to put someone in place who has, yes, a formal power, but actual difference which these people make is you know, in day-to-day decisions is relatively minimal. So what this tells us about leadership for today is that often symbolism around the importance of someone who holds a leadership position is sometimes inversely correlated to their actual power within a structure.
That's interesting. So basically, a load of pomp and ceremony means low real terms.
It's almost like an act of insecurity.
Yeah. Look at me. I'm the big guy.
I'm the king.
Kiss the ring. yes. So, yeah. I wonder if that is controversial. That feels about right, though, doesn't it?
It feels true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd have said it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Charles wouldn't like hearing it. Okay, so let's sum up then. Why do we need leaders? Did we ask Andre?
Yes, we did.
We need leaders for a range of reasons. One is coordination, giving us a sense of direction as a group. A second reason is for meaning. When we're in a group, we want to feel like the task we're doing is important, it has relevance, and it makes a difference in our own lives and other people's lives. And the third reason, and I think often this is more important, is that Leaders give us a sense of connection. They help us to connect to the group and connect with other people, and ensure that members of the group behave well. And if you get people who aren't behaving well, they're punished, and those who are behaving well are rewarded.
I don't want to lead your cricket team. I don't want to lead your features team. I don't want to be your local councillor.
Yeah.
But you can still connect with me. It's fine.
Yeah. You don't want to be social glue, do
you? I don't
want
to do the admin.
No. But then you can delegate the admin.
Yeah. True.
You just be a figurehead. You get your vice captain to do all of the...
That's been done, actually.
Yeah. I bet it has, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, I don't have any particular ambitions, unless it's thrust upon me, and then I would do it.
And I don't really want to be led.
No.
I want to do my own thing. I will do my own thing when I'm ready, at a time that of my choosing.
Suits you, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something in this.
I can't understand the mentality of anybody who wants to be led. I really don't get it at all. I think that's probably a flaw in my personality.
No, I think sometimes people just like being given a sense of direction if maybe they don't have it themselves. Like feeling that they belong to something, like that's bigger than just them.
Yeah.
I don't think you like either of those things.
No. There is nothing nothing bigger than just me.
Yeah, you want to set your own direction on your own.
Yeah, yeah. I know, it's given me a lot of food for thought, this.
I sort of, in some ways, I'd love to see you as a leader. I think it would be...
I mean, I'd be good if I chose to do it. But it would. I'd last a couple of weeks, and I'd be like so bored with this. So fucking over this.
Yeah, which isn't great from a leader.
Yeah. I mean, I remember like one of the things at New Scientist was that somebody was not performing at all. And so I went to my boss and I said, look, this is terrible. And like everyone's carrying this person. Surely we should get rid of them. And apparently that was unacceptable sort of solution mongering. It's like, no, you can't do that. You have to find a way to make it work. And I was like, that's so much work.
And did you?
No, I left. Yeah.
I mean, it's not great problem solving for you.
No, I made it somebody else's problem. Solve my problem.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Andre Spicer. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. Or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.